And welcome to a Disability Law Show. We're back at it. John Scholes here, as always, the brains of the operation. Tamara Gopian, also in attendance. She will be answering all of your questions and emails and giving you the knowledge. If any time you'd like to reach out to Tamara and her team, they always encourage you to do so. And that would be 1-855-821-5900, help@disabilityrights.ca is the email address. We'll start getting your emails here in a few minutes. We've got lots of them piling up, so we'll try to whittle away the stack as we go on through the hour. But we always start off, as you know, Tamara, with a case that you've been working on or something that relates. What do you got? What do you got this week, pal?
Well, I've been working on a matter that has a subject matter. The disability itself is one that we see quite a bit. And so I thought we would start out our show talking about this particular situation. And it involves individuals who have chronic pain, who then very closely will develop mental health conditions, typically anxiety and depression. And look, John, I always put the caveat out there. We're lawyers, right? We're not doctors, but we do disability law so readily and so extensively that we've had to, as lawyers, educate ourselves a little bit about how these kinds of conditions work. And chronic pain in particular, you could just Google it and it'll tell you that most people who have these persisting pain will inevitably also have mental health conditions like anxiety and depression. And so there's a couple of cases I'm working on, one in particular that brought this situation to mind. And I think in the context of what insurers are doing with claims like this, we absolutely always see the same theme, right? This idea that these kinds of conditions, pain, fatigue, depression, anxiety, they're all, you know, self-reported. They're things that you cannot see on a scan, specifically things that you cannot test for necessarily. And We still see insurance companies and adjusters looking at these claims and saying, well, you know, we just don't have enough, quote unquote, objective medical information to validate the things that you were saying.
Right.
And, you know, they go on and deny these kinds of claims very readily, which is probably why we see such a high degree of them come up and, you know, and deal with them. And they resolve, John. Like, I mean, we get involved, they get resolved. But why I wanted to feature them was this idea of this subjective and objective. And try and educate our listeners around, well, if you've got a profile like this, first and foremost, it is an absolutely valid disability claim. I sound like a broken record, but it absolutely is, because those symptoms themselves have been validated by the courts to say, yep, if you have just depression, if you have just anxiety, if you have just pain, that is going to warrant you being entitled to disability benefits if it's impacting you to such a degree that you cannot work. And that's really the key here, right? Is that you want to make sure that you've got the medical support, the treatment there. And again, not easy to treat, right, John? Chronic pain in and of itself is very difficult to treat. But I see my clients doing all of those right things. And so I wanted to share that with our listeners, because the more there is treatment-oriented focus on trying to deal with these different symptoms, I find generally it becomes that much more validated in the eyes of the insurance company and the adjuster and whoever it is that's reviewing the claim. Yeah. I don't know why that is. I think partly, as I said, it's because they have to take the individual's account as to how much they are suffering in order to sort of establish that disability claim. But regardless, in my mind, if you've got a good doctor, if you've got a good therapist, if you've got a good physiotherapist, you know, those individuals who are really focused on your recovery, even if it's to get you to a point where you're just having, you know, a regular life, maybe you're not even working, just being able to go grocery shopping, get out of bed and like this kind of thing. Even that in and of itself is super helpful, because if the insurance company does end up doing what they inevitably do, which is to deny these kinds of claims, and you do seek out the help that I think you should be getting from one of us, myself, someone on our team, then we will lean on those practitioners to get that kind of validation, I suppose, or records or the explanation that, look, even with treatment, my patient is still suffering, my patient is still not able to do these four things. But it cannot happen in a vacuum. And so I think the problem with these kinds of conditions, especially the mental health ones, is that people retreat, right? I don't want to get out of bed. I don't want to leave my house. They can't even get their heads around even accessing that treatment. And I think that is the starting point. Even family doctors, who I know are absolutely overwhelmed right now, in Ontario and BC and Alberta, all the provinces that we practice in. But even if they make the referrals, even if they suggest certain medication, the wait times are long, but just that in and of itself will help support the idea that, look, my patient simply cannot work. You know, this is not something that's conceived of, that's, you know, that nobody's out there trying to trick the insurance company. I mean, these are legitimate disability claims. But insurance companies are so cynical, they're very focused on having that justification in their file to approve benefits, to continue paying benefits. And so when you've got that kind of treatment in place, it can be that much more compelling to the insurer to say they've made the wrong decision, because they will, right, John? I mean, you know, look, I come at it with seeing the denials more so than the approvals, but even when they're approved for a period of time, typically these things get denied because insurance companies get impatient and they really want you off claim. But at the end of the day, when we start that legal claim, they're going to be much more reasonable in their approach. And I think they become more reasonable when we can demonstrate to them, look, there's some validity to what's happening to this particular individual's claim, whether it's chronic pain, disability, you know, whether it's mental health, whether it's one or the other or both, all of those things that the insurers know, at least their lawyers know what I know, which is that the courts will say this is a valid disability if the doctor is supporting that you cannot work.
It's always, well, not always, well, yeah, I guess it's always been the case, but it is getting better that, you know, we always talk in the show when it comes to disabilities of the, you know, mental nature, I guess you could say. It's always, you know, they want that x-ray, they want something on an MRI, something they can look at and go, okay, yeah, there it is, yeah, okay, you're approved. Right. But they don't get that with mental health. Well, that's not the point. It's still disabled, right? They're still disabled.
Yeah, it, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, it can be so disabling. Right. Like, you know, when I talk to my clients who have, let's leave aside the physical aspects of it, but when they're just suffering from the mental health aspect of it, it can be absolutely crippling, you know, to the point where they can't sort of form sentences at times, where, you know, they can't watch a show, they can't read a newspaper article, like really simple things can be very challenging, right, when you've got anxiety and depression. And there are tests they can do, I mean, scales, but again, it's all self-reported. What I'm seeing, though, as a trend, John, is that, yeah, you know, insurers are coming a little ways, but what they're doing more aggressively now, I find, is doing assessments and getting people into their own, the insurer's own rehab plan or rehab treatment provider or whatever, even for mental health. And so they're forcing people to, you know, go through these assessments where their insurance company's own doctor is doing the diagnosis. And then from there, saying, well, you have to see our psychiatrist or our psychotherapist for further therapy. And what I don't like about that, I think, is that it doesn't afford claimants the freedom to have a treatment provider that's not, you know, that's at arm's length, right? That's not the insurance company who's paying for it, so that you can feel, at least as a claimant, that who you're seeing for mental health treatment is someone who really ultimately cares about your best interest and your recovery. And not, you know, the bottom line of the insurer who has said, look, we're going to give you 10 sessions because at the end of it, we think you can get back to work. And so, yes, there's perhaps more of a recognition that these things can be disabling, but the tactics are the same. The idea is, look, if they're going to, you know, try and have these people on claim, they want to shorten that duration and they want to make sure that the focus is always return to work based. Because it's not as linear as a broken arm, right? Where you say, okay, it's broken, we do surgery, we put a cast in, we're going to do physio, and whatever period of time you're back at work. And I think that is the biggest thing with insurers dealing with mental health claims, is that they have to have these tools and means to try and pressure people either off claim or back at work so that it doesn't impact the bottom line. And, you know, we talk about this a lot, but there's one insurer who will actually do a cost-benefit analysis on that, and they'll sort of look at it and say, yeah, you know, if we can shorten the claim by 5 months, and we those 5 months would cost us X, but if we spend, you know, 10% of that on rehab, we're going to do that instead because it's going to mean that we're going to be able to close out the claim. So very much, you know, the insurers are very much live to what those dollars and cents are. They're very profit-driven. And, you know, like I said, full circle, even though there might be some, you know, moving of the needle with a recognition that these things can be disabling, it doesn't mean that they're keeping people on claim for the duration of what really should be the duration of these types of claims, which sometimes can be a lifelong condition. And I think that's really what the bottom line is with anxiety and depression, is that It may go away. It may come back. It has a very relapsing and remitting nature of it. And that's just the antithesis of insurers. They don't want to keep paying you for those periods of time, right? They want you back off and cut you off or whatever it is. And that justifies closing out the claim.
And again, reaching tomorrow anytime, guys, 1-855-821-5900 to have your own conversation and help at disabilityrights.ca. It's interesting you say they're lining people up with their doctors and their therapists. I think it's number one. I know we might come back after the break and talk a little more about this, but number one, do you have to go to their practitioner? Number two, it's not like, you know, a knee replacement where you're going to be under anesthetic, so the doctor really doesn't matter. Bedside manner is not a big factor. When you're coming to mental illness, it is all how you get along with the therapist. I mean, that is key. If you don't jive with the person they're sending you to, you're not going to get better. It's bespoke treatment. You know, it's like the insurance company doesn't pick the car you buy either or the food you eat. Why would they pick your doctor?
Absolutely. I mean, John, absolutely. And I think that's the biggest hurdle for people is the idea that, you know, they may have established a relationship with their own treatment provider, maybe a therapist mm-hmm. that their own doctor had recommended. And now they've sort of got to either stop that treatment or, you know, pivot that treatment so that they can comply potentially with policy terms that say, if we think you should, you must, right? And so, yeah, you know, we should maybe pick this up after the break, but let's talk a little bit about what that looks like for appropriate treatment. And, you know, the legitimate challenges that people face, having to talk to someone entirely new who yeah. they know the insurance company has lined them up for about all of their mental health disability and their right. claim and the for all of that. It's just not the right approach, I think, to reach someone to the point of recovery.
We'll continue that discussion after a short break, which we'll get into now. It's going to be a quick one, so stick around for it. And always send your email along. They might appear on this show or a future show. That is help@disabilityrights.ca. And to reach Tamar and her team directly, 1-855-821-5900. We'll continue right here on the Disability Law Show. Hang in there. You bet. We're back. Disability Law Show. Tamar Agopian. Want to reach out to Tamar and her team. Professionals will take care of you. If it's only for a chat or something you know, more constructive or something that's going to go a little deeper, it doesn't matter. Just make the phone call. Start with that. 1-855-821-5900. Won't cost you a cent to pick up that phone. You can send along an email anytime to Tamar too. help@disabilityrights.ca. And for any other questions, you can ask anonymously. If you think something you don't want to talk to anybody necessarily, just type it in. Go to mydisabilityquestions.com. Free and anonymous website built just to do that. But lots of ground still to cover with the remainder of the hour tomorrow. We were talking just before the break about, you know, insurance companies sending you to their treatment providers, which is fine if you're looking at a, you know, you need some work on your neck or you got a disc problem, which even then you prefer your own people. But when it comes to mental right. illness, it is, you know, you can go through 2, 3, 4, 5 practitioners before you get one that you jive with that's going to help you. It's not the fault of the practitioner. There's no malice. There's nothing like that. It's just when it comes to mental illness, you've got to find someone that you really jive with to get down the road of recovery, which will benefit the insurance company in the long run, get you off claim faster if you're getting the proper help. But they don't see it that way sometimes. They want to send you to their people because at the end of the day, we kind of know who's paying them, right?
That's absolutely right. And I think that is what drives it, right, John? And we say this a lot, but it bears mentioning that the insurance company is the one who actually drafts the policy, right? Like they put the words in, they sell it to your employer. Right. Typically, that's, you know, those are the kinds of policies we talk about as these group disability policies. And inevitably, these policies will include something around, you know, appropriate treatment, something around rehabilitation. And so let's get into that a little bit, because that's really the requirement. You know, you asked an important question, which is, if the insurance company says to you have to go to this rehab facility, do you have to go? And, you know, it's sort of a kind of answer, unfortunately, because the policy will have a couple of key sections. One is, while you're getting disability benefits, you have to ensure that you are getting, quote unquote, appropriate treatment. And I've actually seen one insurer will include, when it's a mental health disability, it's got to be a certified psychiatrist or psychologist. So they have specific wording around that. And so it can't just be a social worker, let's say, or some other counselor who doesn't have that specific certification. Right. And so you can imagine in a world where we've had massive backlogs on trying to get people to access that kind of treatment, specifically with psychiatrists and psychologists are very expensive as well, you can see that policy language like this can be a real challenge. And insurers will use that language to say, well, you're not getting the right treatment, not even that you're not getting treatment at all. So that's a problem, absolutely. And then the other part of these policies is this rehabilitation part of the policy that says, well, you should make every effort to recover. You should be making attempts to return back to work. And, you know, if we think that certain treatment or rehabilitation or an assessment even will benefit your claim, then you must attend this or else you're going to lose your disability benefit. And that's really what it comes down to, right, is that they tie it to your ongoing entitlement to LTD, short-term and long-term. So it puts people in a really difficult spot, especially when you're struggling with your mental health. Maybe you've already established a good relationship with your family doctor and a counselor, and now you've got this insurer who's saying, well, we're only going to pay you your disability benefit if you go and see our treatment provider. Not a good situation to be in. That in and of itself causes a lot of anxiety and concerns. And like I said, the courts have recognized all of this. So what do you do in a situation like this? Well, I think that it is important then to lean on your own treatment providers and perhaps try and provide an explanation to the insurer to say, look, if they stop treatment with us now, this is going to set them back. If they start treatment with someone new, we think that's going to be contraindicated to their progress, their health, and so on. Lots of different ways that there could be some pushback to the insurer. I'm certainly not suggesting that it'll be successful, but at least then you've got some support to lean on to say, well, hang on, but my own doctor has said this isn't the right path. I don't, you know, regardless of what your policy might say, insurance company, about me attending this treatment. But at the end of the day, what I find invariably is that people will buckle to that pressure. Sometimes because they can't access their own treatment in time, they just take up the insurance company's option. And they say, okay, I guess some treatment is better than nothing. And they will start that rehab. I think where it becomes a bigger challenge is there's an element of trust that has to be developed with these kinds of therapists for the treatment to be helpful. And so I've had clients who say to me, you know, Tamara, I really trusted the provider that the insurance company set me up with. And then I felt like the rug was pulled under from under me after 2 or 3 months, because then they turned around and they said to the insurance company that I was making enough progress to return back to work. And so I see this so much that you think, well, was that even beneficial? Was that whole process even beneficial for the claimant? And oftentimes it's not, but it certainly is beneficial to the insurer. And that's really what the big challenge is with trying to deal with these disability claims and claimants and these insurance companies, is that we want to at least level the playing field, right, John? Like, we want to at least be able to put this information out there through our shows, through our websites, all the things that we do, but also, you know, have the opportunity to fight for these people and their rights with these kinds of tactics, because the cards can be absolutely stacked against people when I talk about these kinds of policy terms and the challenges of being forced to have to do these kinds of treatment that the insurance company is insisting you have to do, because you need the money that's going to be required to obtain from the disability benefit. So really tough spot. Not you know, it's not insurmountable, and we deal with this a lot. But if you're in the middle of it and you're sort of looking for some guidance, by all means, you know, people should not hesitate to reach out and have a call with us. Our consults are absolutely free, and we can come up with some solutions that hopefully will be, you know, specific to that individual's needs.
I'll give you the number again before we get into our first email. To reach Tamara, 1-855-821-5900 is the way you do that. First on the list is going to be Mo this morning. Says, guys, in May 2015, I was involved in a motor vehicle accident, an MVA. I settled the tort and exhausted the ABs for 5 years, the accident benefits. My counsel has been working to try to get me approved in the catastrophic category. The MVA insurers sent me a notice last week to attend 9 different assessments. I have no issue with attending any of them, but I know they will favor the insurance company since they are doctors who are paid by the insurer. My question is, could any one of these assessments reports affect my LTD claim? My LTD has been in place since 2017 and is my only source of income to live. My concern is that the LTD insurer would get access to the MVA reports, and then the LTD insurer would say to these doctors, what they would say to the doctors contradict my doctors, so I'm being cut off. Am I overthinking this, or am I correct in this line of thinking? Any suggestions would be great, says Mo. Mo sounds like Mo's on the ball.
He is on the ball. He is on the ball, John. This is such a good question. Actually, there's a few questions in here. So, just for the benefit of our listeners, let's take a step back and just explain what these terms are: MVA, AABs, tort, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
When you are involved in a motor vehicle accident in Ontario, there's a couple of different insurers that get involved in that process. And because we have a no-fault regime in Ontario, and so you would go to your own insurance company if you are injured to access certain benefits that you would have under your insurance plan with your own auto insurer. And so those are called typically accident benefits. And there's different categories of it, John. There's an income component, there's a treatment component, there's four or five different buckets of compensation, but that's the path that you would take with your own auto insurer. Now, if the accident and your injuries were caused by another driver or some other party, you know, I've seen pedestrians or what have you, there's a whole host of situations, but if the injuries were caused by someone else, then you also have the ability and the right to pursue that individual for pain and suffering, and again, other buckets of compensation like income loss and so on. And that is called a tort claim. And so a tort is always, you know, thy neighbor. That's the main thing that I always think about from law school. So if thy neighbor caused your issue, you can sue thy neighbor for these claims. And so, you know, with motor vehicle, now you may be potentially looking at some other driver's insurance company compensating you as well, over and above potentially what you're getting from your own auto insurer for compensation for rehabilitation and this kind of thing. So those are the two main features of motor vehicle situations. But now you've got a third aspect, which is what Mo comes to us for, which is long-term disability benefits. Because if Mo was employed somewhere, or perhaps he had his own private plan, on top of accident benefits and potentially compensation from tort, is the potential of getting short-term and long-term disability benefits. So the first step really is, when you're involved in a motor vehicle accident, you really want to make sure that you're accessing all of these different means of compensation. You also want to make sure that if you're not sure, you're calling the right firm, firms like ours, who can navigate this for you. We've got a fantastic clerk who helps with the AB claims. We've got a few lawyers on our team who deal with the tort claims and obviously the disability claims, because you don't want to be leaving any money on the table. And these kinds of benefits and compensation do actually work together. There's some law around that about who pays first and then who takes credit for what and what have you. But to the point that Mo is making, let's go to the heart of the question, which is, he is now being asked by his lawyer in the motor vehicle claim to attend a number of assessments to justify or to confirm that he's got what's called, quote unquote, a catastrophic impairment. It's a very specific term. And if you are approved, or if there's agreement medically that you do have this catastrophic injury or catastrophic impairment, it allows Mo actually to access a lot more accident benefits, a higher limit of accident benefits. More compensation could be available. So I can absolutely understand why his lawyer is encouraging him to attend these assessments, but it is a fair question to ask, well, what if I go to these assessments and then my disability insurer gets wind of these? And what if they say something different than what my own doctors are saying? And so I expect, now I don't know this, but I expect that Mo has already told his insurance company that, you know, my disability arises from a motor vehicle claim and I've got these other claims going on. And insurers are at liberty to communicate with one another. And sometimes the authorizations that people sign out of the gates allows the insurers to communicate with one another. So I have seen disability LTD adjusters be in touch with the accident benefits adjusters about what's happening with the AB claim and gleaning from that and learning from that and perhaps even sharing information. So you want to be careful actually about what it is that's happening by way of communication, because if Mo hasn't specifically authorized it, it could be that it's not automatic that those reports and those assessments, right, go necessarily to the LTD insurer. Likely, which is why I give him a big credit here, because it is likely that those assessments will get there. And so it then becomes that much more important that his own treatment providers, his own doctors, are being very clear about his disability status, where he's at from a health perspective, and putting that into context if he ends up with these assessments that go against what his own doctors are saying. The disability insurer is going to make an independent decision. And the fact that he's been getting LTD benefits since 2017 tells me, I think, that he has probably been approved beyond that, you know, magic change of definition.
For sure.
So, you know, the disability insurer has accepted there's unlikeliness that he's capable of doing any other work. And so it would have to be a pretty darn good assessment or two or three that very clearly goes against his own doctors for the insurance company to be so bold after so many years to cut him off on that basis. So it's a risk for the disability insurer as well. And, you know, it would be on them to make a fair assessment and not compromise Mo's claim just because they hear from the AB adjuster, you know what, we've got a couple of reports we think are going to be golden. I think at the end of the day, the decisions and the opinions from his own doctors are going to reign supreme. And in fact, that's what the courts have said, is that those are the more compelling decisions than a hired gun or a hired expert that concludes otherwise.
Mo, I bet you weren't expecting that kind of answer, huh? That's why we have Tamar here all the time. She answers it from front to back for sure. But if you have any questions left over, for sure reach out. You've got the email, obviously, but the phone number, 1-855-821-5900. We'll take a short break, and then we're going to bounce over that other website I mentioned, mydisabilityquestions.com, for a question from there, and then back to email. We got lots more to cover in the remaining time here in the show, but always feel to reach out, and maybe your stuff, your questions will get on air on a future show as well as we continue more of the Disability Law Show. Hang in there. And we are back. The Disability Law Show continues. Tamar Agopian from Samfiru Tamarkin LLP. Feel free, do not be bashful, to reach out anytime to Tamar and her team. And if you've listened to the show before, this is your first time listening to the show now, you'll realize that the descriptions and answers are really well thought out and lengthy, which is good. The more information we can provide, the better. So reach out to Tamar and her team, 1-855-821-5900, help@disabilityrights.ca, or as I mentioned, the website we're going to go to now called mydisabilityquestions.com. It's a beauty because it's free. It's anonymous. It's also got a searchable database. That's the way the algorithm works. So if a question similar to yours has been asked and fully answered in the past, you can search it, and that'll save you some time. If not, leave your question there, and it will it'll be in the queue to get answered for sure. Here we go. So this guy was diagnosed with an autoimmune condition about 7 years ago. I have it for life, and there is no cure for it. Does this give me the option of receiving LTD benefits since I've been at my employment for 29 years? What do you think about that, Tamar?
I like this question a lot, John, because you know, we see a lot more of these autoimmune conditions. And so, you know, I think about my clients who have these kinds of hepatitis and other things that, you know, that are autoimmune based. And when you think about individuals like this through the pandemic, right, it wasn't that long ago that people who have autoimmune conditions were very prone to getting COVID, and that was fatal to some people who had these kinds of underlying conditions. So certainly a serious health issue, potentially. And to this, you know, writer's comment about this is a lifelong condition. There is no cure for these kinds of autoimmune issues. And so could it entitle you to LTD benefits? Absolutely. Absolutely it could. But the key is, are your doctors saying that the symptoms around your autoimmune condition is what's preventing you from working?
Right.
Having a condition, right, in and of itself, John, doesn't necessarily entitle you to LTD benefits, or short-term for that matter, both STD and LTD. Because the test is, are you totally disabled from doing the essential duties of your own occupation? And so I'm not sure how much to read into this, but the fact that this individual has had this autoimmune condition for 7 years and yet has managed to work for, it sounds like, all of those 7 years and has long service with his or her employment suggests to me that perhaps, you know, his or her doctor has not necessarily recommended that they stay off work as a result of this condition. And that's the key. It doesn't necessarily have to establish, you know, the causation element of it. It doesn't have to be that necessarily the autoimmune condition is what prevents you from working. But if there are symptoms arising from that condition, if there are flares, for example, from that condition, if it sort of goes and comes and there's, you know, poor control and a whole host of other things that I can think of, and that in and of itself prevents you from working, then by all means, that's the support that you need. You need it to come from the doctor. You need those forms completed, and you initiate that process for disability benefits to the insurer, and then you see what they have to say. But they are going to look at it the way that I would look at it, which is, if you've managed to work all this time with this condition, what has changed? And you really do need your doctor to explain that progression. And the disability forms, they're no good, John. I despise forms, actually. It's too easy for the doctors to just put, you know, check off boxes or put one or two sentences in into the little spaces that they're provided. In a situation like this, where you've got something that's perhaps progressive, getting worse over time, you know, something that you're struggling with that you've had for a while, a condition like this, you want the doctor to be able to explain that progression and say, look, he or she has been under my care for the last decade. You know, they've been managing it with this and that. We've been doing these things. They've been fine. But, you know, the last 6 months, these are the symptoms that he or she has been struggling with. And we've come to the decision that he or she should not be continuing to work. That really is, I think, the right profile to have a disability claim in a situation like this that will get approved. It's not that it shouldn't be approved, John, but you know, insurance companies, if there's an opportunity to deny, they will.
Big time.
And they will use your ability to work against you. That's the worst part. And so, you know, I come at this, you know, having seen this time and again, and just putting it out there to our listeners that that medical explanation becomes that much more important when you've got a condition like this.
And we hope that was a good answer to that particular question. Again, you can file yours and leave yours at mydisabilityquestions.com. I think we got time to get into an email here from Ryan. It says, guys, I got a letter from my insurance company saying that my benefits have been suspended because I have not provided them with the medical they asked for. Can they do this? The letter also says they tried to contact me by sending me three prior letters. I feel threatened for something so innocent. I did send in forms to the right department and everything they've asked for so far. I've also sent numerous emails asking for bigger font sizes on written communications because I have trouble reading small font, but I still got this letter and my benefits still got suspended. Anything I can do about this?
This is terrible, right? This is terrible, John, because you said to the insurance company, hey, like, I can't read this stuff really well. Yeah. Can you just, you know, make some kind of accommodation? And yet I see insurers, you know, doing these bog standard letters. They've got a template and they just fire these things off. And so what Ryan is facing is a compliance issue. This is where people's benefits get suspended or cut off because they haven't complied, quote unquote, with requests that the insurance company is making. And so you want to be responsive to the insurer, certainly. And it sounds like he has been. So where's the disconnect? Where's the disconnect between what the insurance company is saying, which is, look, we tried to reach you a few times. We haven't gotten what we need. And Ryan saying, well, I've sent you what you need. So if he's got trouble with the communication he's getting in writing from the insurer, pick up the phone, get on the phone, call the insurance company, call the customer service line, get to the bottom of this and say, hey, I have trouble reading these things. I understand I got a letter. I had a friend help me figure out what it said. I need to get a hold of my adjuster. I've also sent this material and chase it down. Now, the trouble, though, then is, then what happens? Because, you know, we say this a lot on the show, John, you want to get it in writing from the insurance company. And if they don't put it in writing, you should put it in writing. So what do you do in a situation like Ryan's? And I think that that's where you really do need to lean on someone to help you document this. So keep a log to the extent that you can. You know, I sent this on this day. I called this person on that day, spoke to them, right? And maybe a friend can put that log into an email to your adjuster or customer service at the insurance company or what have you, so that they can remedy it. Because if the insurance company has what they need, then in theory, they should not be suspending your benefits and having those kick back up again. If there's something more that they need, perhaps they've reached out to your doctor and your doctor's not responding to their inquiries, well, then you want to find that out too, so that you can get on the horn with your doctor and say, hey, doc, they've asked you for these forms. Can you fill them out and send them? Because I'm not getting my LTD benefit while you're waiting around, you know, trying to complete these forms. So again, insurance companies are required to justify releasing that benefit every month. They need certain things in their file. They need to make sure that you're responsive to their inquiries. Sometimes they can be a bit aggressive with all of that. But at the end of the day, if there's a disconnect, you want to remedy that, because the hope is that it is generally a quick fix. And from what Ryan's describing, it sounds like he's provided everything. So he wants to make sure they get to the bottom of this so that his benefits are resumed.
Ryan, appreciate that note, pal. You want to reach out with a phone call afterwards, you have the option to do so. If you haven't heard it already, 1-855-821 5900, short break. More questions to go. We're going to go back to mydisabilityquestions.com as well. That is coming right up as we continue more of the Disability Law Show. Stay with us. Yeah, this is the Disability Law Show. Beyond this hour, you can always reach out to Tamar and her team, ready for that phone call. That's why we do the show, to raise awareness and get you solving some of your problems. You need help with it. Tamar and her team can do it. Samfiru Tamarkin, LLP, is who you're calling. 1-855-821-5900. Help at disabilityrights.ca, or this website, free, anonymous to ask questions, mydisabilityquestions.com. We're going to pull another one from there tomorrow. So here we go. Says, guys, been watching YouTube looking for a lawyer. I have a lawyer for an ongoing employment case and at the same time dealing with STD, short-term disability, which will hopefully turn into long-term. My lawyer says he doesn't know anything about LTD, so I've been trying to get answers off the internet. Never good. You seem to know exactly about both subjects. Can I hire you hourly to get some questions answered? I live in Jersey, by the way.
This is great, right?
That's a great
this
question.
Is the advent of our world right now that we have, you know, we're on the internet. Yep. We've got YouTube videos there of our shows. You know, it's amazing to me that we are getting so much traction from people down south and lots of different provinces. This is what we want. And so the short answer is that I think we can help, but I am a little concerned about a lawyer that he's got who's claiming to know about short term but not about long term. Okay,
right.
And so this always kind of bugs me because, you know, look, our firm specializes in both employment and disability law for a reason, because the two are often tied quite closely together, and you want to make sure you have lawyers who understand both of those components of a particular claim. And so, can we assist people when they've got both of those claims? Absolutely. And in fact, you want a lawyer to actually do that analysis to think about, does it make sense to deal with your employment issues perhaps before you deal with your disability issues? And in the vast majority of cases, John, it makes more sense to deal with your disability claim first than your employment claim. And really, the number one reason for that is money, right?
Yeah.
The insurance companies will put into their policies that they get credits for other sources of income, places where you might get money from. And your employer is typically one of those sources. So if you get a bunch of money from your employer for a severance, let's say, then some insurers will get a full credit for every dollar you got for your severance. Well, why would you want that if the insurance company should be paying you disability benefits, right? First and foremost. So oftentimes we have to do that analysis, but we're in the best position to do that kind of analysis and give this, you know, these kinds of individuals the right advice. But he or she has also asked us some questions around, you know, what if someone is living in Jersey, let's say, and, you know, they're looking for the right lawyer in the right jurisdiction. The key driver there is, well, where did your issues arise? Was this individual employed in one of the provinces that we operate in? Then by all means, we can help, right? Is the insurer an American insurer? That's okay too. If you live in Canada and you've got a claim in Ontario, let's say, since this show is in Ontario, then by all means, we could assist that individual as well. And so again, another element of this idea of jurisdiction, right? What's the right jurisdiction? Where do you want to find the lawyer that you need in the place that you need it? And again, we've got a great team who answers people's calls every day. And this is something that comes up every now and again, where someone might not be in Ontario or Alberta or BC, but it's still someone that we can assist with because their claim arose in one of those jurisdictions. So again, a technical issue, but one that we can overcome. And then the other question here is, you know, can I hire you hourly to get some questions answered? Well, our consults are free. Call us. Let's have a chat. I'm happy to answer some questions, but then hopefully you won't be surprised if I tell you that you might need to hire a different lawyer to pursue your disability claim. Look, I think that it's very fact-driven. I never want to suggest to people that we're the only answer, right, John? But I think what's helpful with our team, myself and everybody else on our team, is that we are available to answer these kinds of questions. We do these consultations for free for a reason. And we want to make sure that we're giving people transparent advice so that it's not this imbalance of power. If your employer is saying something to you and you're not sure, or your disability insurer is saying something to you and you're not sure, they're not necessarily going to give you a full picture, whereas we will. And we'll sort of look at it very impartially. And we'll also suggest to you if you've got a basis for a good legal claim, in which case, by all means, you know, we can start that retainer process, and our disability claims are entirely on contingency. We are not going to be charging you hourly. So we only get paid if we are actually successful in recovering money on your behalf against the insurance company for benefits. So no down risk as far as I'm concerned in this kind of a format. And also the starting point being that we want to provide as much information for people to make the right choices and decisions that they can about their health and their employment.
Appreciate you reaching out. Let's get to Lucy's email. A quick one here, 2 minutes, see how much of this we can answer. Actually, you know what? I'm going to go for Lee. Lee's a little bit shorter, and I think we can get in. Says, hi, guys. I was terminated from my job 14 years ago today, and I've been on LTD for roughly the last 7. My employer said my contract has been frustrated, and they're giving me 2 weeks severance on my vacation pay accrued. Is this legal?
So, Lee, I mean, if there is no reasonable prospect of you returning back to your employment, then in Ontario, potentially, yes, this could be appropriate. If you are working for an employer who is protected under the Employment Standards Act, then this could be something that's called frustration of contract. And look, the law protects you for certain minimum entitlements under this legislation. The thing is, though, it says to me that you were terminated from your job after 14 years. Well, it might be that you're entitled to much more than 2 weeks. And I think that's where I'm a little concerned that perhaps your employer is trying to shortchange you as to what those protections are under the law. So again, the first question is there any reasonable prospect of you returning medically? And then frustration can be triggered on that basis, not just simply in a vacuum to say, okay, well, if there's no reasonable prospect, then there's certain entitlements that you get under the law. And those entitlements could potentially be 8 weeks of termination pay or pay in lieu of notice, and then an additional 14 weeks of compensation under the Employment Standards Act. So certainly one, John, I think that may be requiring a consultation after our show so that we can make sure that Lee is getting a fair shake from his employer. But the legality around it, I think there is, generally people assume that because they're on a medical leave that they are protected and they're never going to get terminated. Generally speaking, yes. But if you have been off work for a prolonged period of time, and again, if you're not medically capable of returning, and there's evidence of that, then it could form the basis of what's called frustration of contract. But as I said, it's a legal principle. So it's not something that just exists just because you've been off work for 7 years. It's got to be based on something medical before your employer or you as a claimant can trigger that. Because we've done that too. I've triggered frustration of contract on behalf of some clients before, in order to get them out of their employment situation and get the, dollars that they are entitled to under the law against their employer.
And with that, we've got a wrap for the day, but appreciate all of your correspondence and reaching out for sure. Continue to do so. Never stop doing that, right? It's always good to hear from you. To get a hold of Tamar and her team, 1-855-821-5900. That email always is help@disabilityrights.ca. And then finally, mydisabilityquestions.com to ask any other questions on your own time. And we'll catch you next time right here on the Disability Law Show.
The preceding was a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of Corus Entertainment.